Hello and good evening, everyone, or from wherever in the world, whatever time zone you're in right now. Hopefully, we've got people from outside of the UK joining us too. This event is actually a collective event, bringing together a whole group of organizations and individuals who have been at the forefront of Palestine activism, trying to effectively hold the state to account for its role in the continued ongoing genocide taking place in Palestine. We have obviously organizations like Palestine Action and many figures and individuals who have been reporting on what's taking place there, standing on the streets. They've been protesting outside buildings, shutting buildings down. We've had a whole host of actions taking place, all for one purpose, which is to really bring this genocide to an end, inshallah. I just wanted to share a quick reflection, though, before we get into to the speakers tonight. Now, by the way, sorry, I should have introduced myself. My name is Asim Qureshi. I'm the research director of the advocacy organization CAGE International. 21 years ago, I was studying for my master's in international human rights law at SOAS when we got a message around this time, 21 years ago, that somebody that I looked up to as an older brother in South London, a man by the name of Babar Ahmed, was brutally beaten by the police in a counter-terrorism raid. Tony, I think you might have to change the screen because function is doesn't seem to be on the speaker. But I'll carry on while we sort that out. So Barbara was unfortunately
Any
beaten
better?
quite. Yes, that's better. Thank you.
Yeah.
Barbara was unfortunately beaten quite badly by the police to the extent, and it was such an Islamophobic attack that the police, when they pinned him down to the ground after like beating his face and his body, he had lacerations or everywhere across his body. They said to him, "Where is your God now?" In this kind of like Islamophobic moment of police brutality, it was a horrible moment for us in the community. And I remember the sense of outrage, the utter sense of disgust that accompanied this specific event. It was the moment that really convinced me, at least, that I need to spend my life working for people like him, because I knew Barbara. This was a counter-terrorism raid. I knew him. He was somebody that I knew because when I was much younger, he had gone off as a teenager to fight in Bosnia and to defend an oppressed people who were facing a genocide. And it's so interesting for me that 21 years later, we're talking about people who are being raided, who take conscionable acts, who stand up for justice, who are there for others when they are needed. And yet, the people who are standing up for the oppressed are the ones who are being criminalized, who are having this counter-terrorism regime used against them. And that moment, Barbara's beating was the one that really, for want of a better term, and I think that we should use this word in a positive way, radicalized me, it politicized me, it made me convinced that I couldn't work in a corporate law sector for the rest of my life. But there was another element to that raid, which was a little bit more difficult, which was the fear that it created amongst the community in South London. There were people that would approach Barbara's family and ask for their phone numbers to be removed because they were worried that their children, or them, they might be targeted and raided in the same way. Now, 21 years later, I think what we're seeing is a great deal of learning happening in that period of time. We have organizations and institutions, we have solidarity taking place in an unprecedented way. And I think this event tonight is really a testament to that type of solidarity that we're seeing people coming together, not allowing for the fear of the state to dictate how they act, not shying away from realizing that actually standing forward, standing at the front, standing alongside one another, not allowing the label of terrorism in these types of cases to dictate how you behave and respond can really bring about a massive shift in the way that we understand what counterterrorism legislation is and how it's instrumentalized. Now, we have a number of really fantastic speakers that we're going to hear from tonight. And, I want to give everybody their due time and, you know, allow them to speak without having to pull them off too quickly. But we're going to start with a video from I believe it's Natalie Strecker, who was arrested. Unfortunately, she can't speak herself tonight because she's been given legal advice that it's probably better not to speak about the details of her case at this time. But Tony, are you able to play the video for us,
I'm gonna
please?
have a good go, okay?
Okay,
Right.
thank you.
Right, can everyone see that?
Good evening, guys. My name is Natalie Strecker. Unfortunately, I'm not able to take part in this evening's panel following guidance given to me by my lawyer. However, after conversation, I recognise how important it is to highlight how legislation is being weaponized in order to silence dissent against those working to try to stop a genocide and hold the parties responsible to account. So, what I agreed to do was just send a really short video explaining what happened to me here in Jersey in the Channel Islands. So, on Friday, the 15th of November at 6:30 in the morning, there was banging on my door. I got up and opened the door and saw two, initially just two police officers, because I could only open up the door a little bit. And I thought something had happened to my family, so I asked what had happened, and I was informed that I was under arrest under Section 13 of our Terrorism Act in Jersey, for inviting support for a proscribed organization, which is utter ridiculous. They said they had a warrant to search the premises. So I was taken down. I was allowed to get dressed, but I had to have the female officer with me at all times. Even when I went to the toilet, I had to keep the door open, and was followed at all times, had to dress in front of her. My husband obviously wasn't allowed to leave or move or anything. I ha stated that I knew fascism was arriving, but it was coming, but it arrived earlier in Jersey than I had expected it to. And I called out the total insanity of them arresting a middle-aged peace activist on the island. I was taken to the station in the back of a van and held for 12 hours. Or between 12 and 14, I was made to wait for 3 hours before I was then interrogated for four. I didn't ask for legal representation, and the reason for this is because there has been an orchestrated campaign of harassment against me, including attempts to lose my job, including that of a state's member, using their position in an attempt to lose me my job, which meant I went through a disciplinary process at work that only actually concluded just recently. But one of those taking part in this campaign against me is a senior associate at a very well-known large law firm. So I didn't feel comfortable accepting a legal representation because I didn't know who it might be. And I didn't know who to call because we don't have anyone. Obviously, this is incredibly new and unprecedented for us here on our island. I answered the questions, those I felt I didn't want to answer. I said no comment to because I was worried about misinterpretation when I was so tired. And I think I recognise that's why they try and scare you and try and tire you out. Although, to be fair, bar one, all the police officers were pretty respectful of me. I've got to say that. Not like I understand they have been in the UK. And I just kept reiterating international law. It turns out that it's to do with my stating what is a substantive fact under international law. I don't want to go into it because I don't want to prejudice my case, but it is utterly ridiculous and totally farcical to claim that what I am doing is criminal when our government is giving not just diplomatic support, but actively facilitating and taking part in a genocide. We know that the International Criminal Court has finally issued arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gantz. So that is my situation. I think it's incredibly important we keep speaking out, we keep using our voices. This process is about intimidation. These charges aren't going to hold, but it's about intimidation. But I think we need to take, find strength and resource in those who walk this path before us, but also in the Palestinians themselves and that demonstration of Sumut. So I'm going to encourage people to not be intimidated by it, to keep moving forward, to keep demanding the application of international law and recognizing what international law actually says about these situations. This is, as everybody knows, the most televised genocide in our history, and our governments and institutions have failed in the most grotesque way. So it really is down to us as ordinary individuals. I take heart in a number of people coming out across the political spectrum, and I think we really need to unite on this and push this back, because we cannot allow this to become normalized. Anyway, you're going to be listening to some incredible people this evening. Solidarity with all of them. And yeah, let's keep standing up. Let's keep using our voices. So thank you. And can I ask also for you there listening to support me too in Jersey, to keep raising awareness, to embarrass our local government and our local police service, embarrass them about how ridiculous this is. So please, it would really mean a lot. I'm quite isolated here, to put the focus on what's happening here, what's happening to me. And, you know, I mean, we've even had people try to shut down our grief circle, a grief circle in a church hall, which is just depraved, to be honest, that the suggestion that grieving the loss of the Palestinians is now considered anti-Semitic, which really endangers Jews, is constant conflation, and they're making the expression mean nothing, which is dangerous in itself. So again, thank you ever so much for your time. I really have appreciated the outpouring of support, and I would say that there's one thing that's been really, that I really found strength in, is just knowing people are aware and supporting me. So thank you so much. Keep going, and as always, free Palestine.
That was really, really powerful. Our thanks to Natalie, and really, I think, you know, whoever else can go out to Jersey to support her as her case progresses, I think we should definitely do our best to make sure that we can go out there and do that. And really, it's counterterrorism legislation that brings this collective together really right now. I think all of our speakers in one way or another have been affected by Section 12. And of course, in Natalie's case in Jersey, Section 13 of the Terrorism Act. And why that's so significant is because, of course, this is nothing new. You know, Natalie herself in her video statement just said, she reminded us to think about those who have walked this path in the past. And when we think about the way that terrorism laws have been instrumentalized throughout the entirety of the colonial period, and in particular, when we think about a context like apartheid in South Africa, where you had police brutality at a level that is almost unprecedented in history. You had great figures like Steve Biko, who were murdered by the police, all under the rubric of counterterrorism legislation. It's actually so interesting right now that if you look at the way that terrorism is defined within South Africa now, the exception that is made is for those who are fighting against apartheid. That is an allowance that is made within the legislation itself. And you know, I use that as a segue to bring in our next speaker, who's Andrew Feinstein, who is a former ANC politician, which is why I was hoping that it would, you know, could connect with you directly, more directly through that. He's a researcher and activist as well, and unfortunately is facing his own difficulties right now. So Andrew, please, if I could give you the floor. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Can you all hear me okay? Great. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation to be a part of this absolutely crucial event. And I'd like to send my personal solidarity to all of those who have faced the sort of experience that Natalie was speaking about, that we've heard about from each of you who are going to speak. And as the chair was saying, let's not forget that all of those who struggled against apartheid, who led the liberation movement against apartheid in South Africa, were described as terrorists. Most infamously, my former boss, Nelson Mandela. Margaret Thatcher did not only describe him as a terrorist and a communist, but also suggested privately to the apartheid regime that they should organize his killing in prison, as it was too dangerous to keep him alive because he was becoming a symbol of everything that they stood against. In other words, actual democracy, actual freedom, actual liberation. So I know it is little solace, but it is worth reminding ourselves that what you are suffering is what many other incredibly courageous, committed people have suffered throughout the ages. We should also not forget that Margaret Thatcher, after advising the South African apartheid state to somehow organize Mandela's death, and there was a wonderful anecdote that Mandela told of after his release, when he came to Britain, he spoke at the Great Hall in Westminster, long before he was our country's president. And Mrs. Thatcher, who had retired, was there and sort of hobbled up to him on her Zimmer frame. And Mandela gave her a big smile and said to her, "You must be surprised to see me here." And she looked confused. And he said, "Well, after all, you advised them to murder me." And for once in her life, she was speechless. But we shouldn't forget that she described as her greatest political achievement Tony Blair. Because she had effectively turned the Labour Party into a neoliberal warmongering party and Tony Blair into a war profiteer who has made, in my very conservative calculation, in excess of £110 million personally from the companies who profited from the invasion of Iraq and from British arms companies like BAE Systems. And for my sins, which are clearly many, I live in the constituency of the bastard son of Tony Blair, Keir Starmer. Now, for those of us who've been subject to this appalling human being for almost 10 years as our Member of Parliament, we know from personal experience that his every instinct is anti-democratic and authoritarian. And of course, this started before he became an active politician. In his time as the Director of Public Prosecutions at the Crown Prosecution Service, he never once allowed the prosecution of an agent of the British state, be it police personnel who were involved in the killing of protesters or British military personnel involved in the murder of innocents in various parts of the world. It is therefore no surprise to us that as soon as he came to power in Britain, something he's been planning for decades, one of the first things he would do is ensure that anti-terror legislation is utilized against everything that could challenge his political project. And what is his political project? It is a project to enrich and empower the billionaires who have funded his political rise and funded his political party and his corporate sponsors. Let us not forget that at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, one of the biggest sponsors of events at that conference was none other than BAE Systems. Now, that project has at its core permanent austerity and forever wars. And the two are incredibly closely related. For in the first budget of this appalling administration, we saw a £3 billion increase in the defence budget and the signing of a blank cheque for whatever the Ukraine requires, in the Prime Minister's words, while at the same time, the scrapping of the winter fuel allowance, which is going to cost thousands of British lives, a refusal to scrap the two-child benefit cap, and further austerity on public transport, the health system, education. And the symbol of this political project is that Britain today is home to more billionaires than at any time in this country's history, while more families are requiring food banks to feed themselves than at any time since the end of the Second World War. The madness of the moment in which we find ourselves is that war is peace. Escalation is de-escalation. Lifelong racists label anti-racists as racist and get away with it. And of course, we have a genocide, as Natalie said, being live streamed every single day that is being committed in our names with our tax pounds. And it is not just that our government is protecting and defending the state of Israel and its genocidal actions. It's even worse than that. By arming this genocide, this country is profiting from it. Our defense companies who make the weapons that Israel is using, our political parties, and our individual politicians who, like Tony Blair and his Labour Party, profited massively from the so-called war on terror. We should also bear in mind that it is this corrupt global arms trade, accounting for 40% of all corruption in all global trade, that oils the wheels of our political systems in the West. But the reality is that today, in the ultimate madness, our putrid, corrupt, mendacious, mediocre government tells us that opposing genocide is now a terrorist offence. Well, let me tell my local MP that arming a genocide, that profiting a genocide, that protecting the genocidaires is, in my opinion, a terrorist offense, a real terrorist offense to stand side by side with Benjamin Netanyahu and his terrorist state. So what do we do in conclusion? We have to continue to write, to speak ever louder. And more than ever before, we have to stand together. The vast, vast majority of us in this country who are disgusted and appalled by what we see on our screens every day and by our government's role in it. We have to stand together and we have to make those who are not with us understand that an attack on any one of you, on any one of us, is an attack on all of us. But finally, we have to remind ourselves just as South Africa was freed from over 340 years of racist oligarchy, so too will Palestine be free.
Thank you so much, Andrew. That was so perfect. And it really sets the tone for so much of what we want to take from this event today. This notion of the moment that we're in, who we're up against. It's something that is much larger than, you know, we sometimes give credit for. There are so many interests at play, many of them corporate interests. But ultimately, what we are building solidarity around is the Palestinian people, their right to self-determination, and their right to just exist right now, because we are in the middle of a genocide and we have to keep on reminding ourselves of that. Somebody who has been consistently reminding us of the role that Israel has been playing, that the Zionist state has been playing, is our next speaker, Tony Greenstein, who is the first Jewish person to be expelled from the Labour Party. He is the co-founder of what he describes as the useless PSC, has been arrested twice, last December under the Terrorism Act for support of a proscribed organization, but you know, no charges after nearly a year. So, Tony, could I please invite you up? Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Asim, for that introduction. I was arrested on December the 20th last year, at 7 o'clock in the morning, by about a dozen police officers from the Southeast Anti-Terror Squad. And I was told I was being arrested for a single tweet that I had posted a month before. I was asked by a Zionist, or told by a Zionist, to say, "I support Hamas." And I said, "No, that is not enough." And I said, "I support this Palestinian resistance, including Hamas." And as anyone knows, a nation or a people under occupation have an international law right to mount resistance. And that, of course, included October the 7th. Britain is in a military alliance with Israel and is bound to the hip with the United States. And everything the police are doing is in furtherance of that military alliance. It has nothing at all to do with compliance with the law. Their interpretation of the law is, to say the least, twisted and distorted. But when we come to the question of genocide, we have a law which is quite clear, the International Criminal Court Act of 2001, which makes participation in, or aiding, or being ancillary to a genocide a criminal offence. But of course, the police have shown absolutely no interest in implementing that law, because if they did, they would have to feel the collar of Keir Starmer and his associates. And Keir Starmer has been consistent in his denial that there is a genocide taking place in Palestine. Indeed, he's encouraged that genocide by saying that Israel has every right to withhold food, water, medicine, fuel, and so on. And Starmer came to power in the Labour Party, promising to root out anti-Semitism. Well, we know what that was about. But if you deny genocide when it's taking place in Palestine before our very eyes, and there's no need to give examples here today of that, the destruction of universities, hospitals, the shooting of children, and those who try to rescue them, etc., then Starmer is absolutely no different from those who deny the Nazi Holocaust. Starmer is a Holocaust denier. And we've seen the trashing of international law in the process, as the police see their job as harassing and intimidating Palestine solidarity activists, and not just Palestine Action, but really anyone who is involved in the Palestine solidarity movement. And they've done this using an obscure clause, Section 12(1A) of the Terrorism Act 2000, And what does that act say? It says anyone expressing an opinion or belief that is supportive of a proscribed organisation, and in doing so is reckless as to whether a person to whom the expression is directed will be encouraged to support a proscribed organisation. The second leg of that is virtually impossible to define. How would you know when you express an opinion or belief what the effect will be on other people? But the act, or the clause, which was inserted by the Counterterrorism Act 2021, makes it quite clear that what it's criminalising is an expression of opinion or belief. In other words, it has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. And it goes on to say that is supportive of a proscribed organisation. In other words, what you say about, for example, Hamas or Hezbollah may indeed be true. But if it's supportive of them, then you are still guilty of a criminal offence. In other words, expressing a truth is in itself criminal. And I just want to take a quick look at the definition of terrorism, because that is the basis on which organisations are proscribed. And it says in Section 1B, the use or threat is designed to influence the government. Well, Hamas has no government. Israel is in illegal occupation of the Gaza Strip, and the International Court of Justice has just ruled to that effect. There is no legitimate government. So how can they be a terrorist organisation? And that is really the nonsense that we are facing. And if people have to think twice before they even speak as to whether they may encourage others to support an organisation, what we're seeing really is the use of the anti-terrorism laws to suppress free speech. And that is not surprising. Repression abroad also has consequences at home. And I want to say that we have to build as broad of an alliance as possible in defence of really ancient democratic liberties like freedom of speech, and freedom of association, because those rights are part of British law. We have adopted the European Convention of Human Rights. And I also have to say that it's a great pity that the bastions of liberal England, whether it's the Guardian or Liberty, the old National Council for Civil Liberties, have run a mile from even mentioning what is happening today. I invited Liberty to provide a speaker for this seminar, this talk, not once, but three times, but they haven't even bothered to respond. So we have a job ahead of us, but I do believe that we can win public opinion, and that if necessary, we will be able to take our cases before a judge and jury and win out there, because it's clear that liberal England has jackknifed into the authoritarian right that Starmer represents so adequately. So thank you very much, and I wish everyone good success.
Thank you so much, Tony, and so much solidarity for you. You mentioned this point about repression and the far-reaching consequences of repression. We're seeing that a lot, especially in the space of journalism. Now, you would think that at a time where journalists, especially when journalists are not permitted to enter into Gaza to report on what's taking place there, that any form of journalism that seeks to provide the truth of what is happening should be welcomed. In fact, you know, some might say that in a genocide, it's actually incumbent upon states to facilitate that level of journalism to take place. But rather, what we see instead is every single mainstream outlet, Guardian included, playing a role in inhibiting the discourse around what is actually taking place in Gaza right now. But we do have journalists who are speaking about this. And the next two speakers that I want to bring on, first Sarah Wilkinson and then Asa Winstanley, have been doing their best to cover what is taking place. So Sarah is an activist for Palestine since the first Intifada. So that's quite some while now, 50 years. She's a member of Palestine Action, been using her online presence and journalism to cover the genocide. So, Sarah, I know you have been through a lot, including having your home raided. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you've been experiencing, please?
Yeah, I think probably most people have heard the story, but so I'll condense it down as much as I can. Sort of very similar to Natalie, it's sort of 10 past seven, there's a knock on the door. And the minute I opened it, we've got 16 balaclavaed, huge men in the house with no identification. There's no way to authenticate if they are who they say they are. They just say they're anti-terror squad. They had a warrant but refused to show it. They were quite violent. They pushed my son up against the wall and then frog marched me up the stairs, didn't allow me to get dressed, didn't allow me to put my shoes on, handcuffed me so tightly that it cut my wrists, didn't allow me to take any medication for my Crohn's, and then threw me into a van, which then promptly in the back of the van, I realized not being able to get ID or authenticate that these were police, that this was an execution. We drove the wrong way, about an hour's drive into a different, towards a different county. Now, I knew where we were going or where we were supposed to be going. So the fact that we were driving into the woods, if you like, I think was done to scare me, was done deliberately. These are local officers, if you like. I don't actually know what to call them. So they know the route. They had a sat nav. There was no excuse for going the wrong way, but they went the wrong way by about an hour's worth of driving. So yes, there was an hour of thinking, okay, I'm going to die at this point. But while I was in custody, which was about 12 to 14 hours, same as Natalie, they absolutely ransacked the house, desecrated my mother's ashes, knelt in them, scattered them everywhere, stole and looted about £400 in money. They took my passport, but didn't list it. So part of my bail conditions were that I surrender my passport in 5 days, which I couldn't surrender because they'd taken it but denied that they had it. So this created another issue. But, you know, I hadn't been able to get dressed. I got no shoes. I got no meds. So I had no food. I had nothing to drink for the whole time that I was in custody, which is, you know, you're dehydrating and you can't sleep, obviously, because you're very wired and very rattled. But the house was absolutely ransacked. And it took seven people and about 5 days to piece by piece put the house back together again. And it was only then that we realized that bank cards were missing, keys were missing. I have a disabled key for the disabled toilets. That's missing. My Crohn's card's missing. Medication was missing. Books autographed by the authors are missing. They've seemed to maliciously taken books that were signed, pictures from the wall. And I can't claim any of these things back because none of them are listed. So all of this stuff is gone. All of these precious items, I can't ask for back ever because they haven't taken them as far as their evidence is concerned. So that was the hideous experience. And I had seven bail conditions, one of which was that I couldn't use a phone. And the problem is with living in an area like this, you can't survive here without a phone. My family live miles away. In fact, everyone lives miles away. I've got no access to fire engines or ambulance. I couldn't use my TV because it's a smart TV. You're very, very isolated in a rural area without any telephone. And I also couldn't borrow a telephone. I couldn't use an electronic device. They've taken about £7,000 worth of equipment, including the chargers for the lights on the stairs. Now, I just need to say at this point, right, they're here because they want to find evidence that I support a proscribed organization. So they're here because they want to find out things about Palestine. So what do the stair lights, of which there are 50, because I have five floors, what are the stair lights? What do they have to do with Palestine? Why take all of the charger cables so that I can't light up the stairs for the grandkids so that they can go up and down without falling? So that was, you know, one of those items that they took, one of many, which have no relation to Palestine whatsoever. It was purely done to ransack and terrorize, which brings me to the next point. that everybody else has made quite clear is that they are saying they are combating terror, but they are using terror tactics. They're terrorizing us as civilians or citizens or journalists to counterterrorism. They're actually using terror tactics. These are terror tactics. And to scare somebody into thinking they're going to be executed, that's another terror tactic. So I'm now going to hand myself in on the 29th of November. I find out that I'm going to be arrested again on the 29th. I've got to go through the whole process again because they now have decided that they may have or may not have found something. I probably can't talk about it that much, but I have to hand myself in. They can't be bothered to come and arrest me because it's so many miles. So I've got to go there to hand myself in, to be arrested, to be interrogated all over again. So it's another 12 hours of sitting in custody without any meds, but at least I'll be dressed. But I did do a bit of research. And, you know, what I found is that, for instance, in a year, there's about 238,000 burglaries that take place in a year across the country. In the north of England, anything above Birmingham, basically, they consider the north, right all the way up to the borders of Scotland. The police in an entire year have not solved one burglary. In an entire year, from October to October, not one burglary. In the south of England, which is anything below the Midlands, through London, Exeter, all the way down into Cornwall, they have only solved 13% of all overall crime. That's, I think, the lowest since about the 18th century or 19th century. I do beg your pardon. So here you can see now that the police are no longer policing. What they're doing is sitting behind desks, eating digestive biscuits and drinking tea and trolling through Twitter, finding things that we might have said or might not have said, listening to all the Twitter spaces so that we might have accidentally said something we shouldn't, going through all of our tweets, but they're not actually policing crime. Now, I did another bit of research. There's been about 20 people I asked who'd rung 999. Only 18 of them, 18 of them, the police didn't turn up between 5 weeks. So on the making of the 99 call, it took the police 5 weeks to reach 18 people out of 20 to respond to the call. So here we again, the police are not actually responding to crime, to actual crime. One of them was quite a violent crime where the young lady, she rang 999 before the crime was committed and they sent her a message. She was hiding in the dark, hoping her attacker would not find her. And they sent her a message which lit up her phone that said, sorry, you've been a victim of crime. And therefore the attack took place because they found her. And then they turned up 5 weeks later and the mother opened the door and said, what's the point of you turning up now? And they said, yes, there's no point. Her injuries are healed. There's nothing to investigate. We're not even going to give you a crime reference number. Now, there was a physical attack that the police have actively said, we're not taking this any further because we've turned up too late. And so this is kind of where we're at now. It is purely at the behest of the Israeli regime is to target, silence, gag, scare, frighten, and make sure that journalists no longer say anything, no longer report anything, activists no longer write anything on a placard and go out and protest, because people holding up signs have been arrested as well. People have been taking down Palestinian flags. So I tried to do a documentary with a colleague of mine to tell them the law about being able to fly Palestinian flags, that it was legal. Palestinian flags have come down out of the windows because people are terrified to fly them. This is, again, it's a form of terrorism. It's frightening and scaring people into not being able to report on one of the most hideous genocides in history. And it's hideous, and I say the most, because it's live streamed. It's coming into our phones every day. We haven't got to wait 5 years for a documentary or somebody to write a book. The reason why it's one of the worst genocides is because we have the evidence now. We have it today. We have it every morning. We see it every day. So there isn't any excuse. We can't say we didn't know about it until it was too late. So that's what makes it one of the worst genocides. And yet now, as Andrew Feinstein so rightly said, it is an act of terrorism to object to terrorism being committed against the Palestinian people, an act of terrorism to oppose mass murder. It's an act of terrorism to shout that the Palestinians deserve freedom and self-determination. It's an act of terrorism to support a resistance which is entirely legal. And even armed struggle is entirely legal. So now all of these things are an act of terrorism, but responding to a 999 attack is not worth the police's while. And this is where we've got to. And I worry with the term incessantness kind of, for me, means that, which the operation was called, is that the police are going to be doing it over and over again, but each arrest, each raid is very different. It's getting slightly worse. We've now got windows and doors being smashed. And, you know, what's going to happen with the next home raids is this sort of arbitrary, well, we can get away with that because nobody dares complain because they don't get anywhere. So now we can smash a few more things up. We can loot a little bit more money. We can take gold and jewelry and get away with it. And we can be really racist at the same time and also get away with that. And so, yeah, I'm concerned as to where this is going to go, how many more raids are going to happen. I think possibly hundreds, because there's so many people have said things on Twitter. So many people have held placards up supporting the resistance. Are all these people going to be arrested one after another after another? And is speaking up for Palestine going to become so difficult that in the end we lose a huge percentage of supporters because they don't dare to speak? And this is a time where we really need to speak out.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah, for sharing that. Yeah, incredibly, incredibly difficult experience that you had with the raid. And it mirrors what we hear from so many people over the last 20 years. I mean, there is one point of correction that I have for you as a lifelong South Londoner. The north of England is everything above the River Thames, just so you know. But yeah, jokes aside, I would like to bring up Asa Withstanley, who is a journalist for the Electronic Intifada, who was raided by counterterrorism police. And Asa, you'll remember the case of my colleague Mohammed Rabbani, who was convicted of a counterterrorism offence for refusing to give his passwords at a port. And, you know, your devices were seized in the process of this raid. So it seems that they do try and use these moments as a way of getting inside our electronic data.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Asim. In some ways, the raid that happened to me was similar to the others. There's certain points of similarity, but there's also points of difference. So especially with what Sarah just outlined. So on the 17th of October last year, police came to my home, counter-terror police came to my home, and they presented me with a warrant to search the premises, warrant for the house, a warrant for the car. And they stated that they had the right to search my home for devices, and they stated that they knew that I'm a journalist. They knew of my profession, is the way they put it. And for anyone watching who doesn't know, I am a journalist with the, as was stated, journalist with the Electronic Intifada. We report on Palestine and Palestine-related issues around the world. I do a lot of reporting on the pro-Israel lobby. I wrote a book called Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, which is about how the pro-Israel lobby played a major role in the downfall of Jeremy Corbyn. And so, you know, they stated that they're aware of the fact that I'm a journalist. So they searched the home. They they said they were looking for devices, and they wanted me to signpost devices that I use for my journalism. So I sought some legal advice, and I did state which ones I use for my journalism. Only after, receiving legal advice, they didn't smash up the home as they did with, in the case of Sarah. And they didn't take all devices in the house. So, they potentially could have done that. But they did in the end take all of my, not every single tool in the house, I suppose. They didn't, there was a, I'm using an SLR webcam. They could have, I suppose they could have taken that. I don't know. It depends how you interpret the warrant. But anyway, they didn't. But they did take all my main devices that I use for journalism. So they took my laptop, my main computer, iPad, phone, and an old phone, and a hard drive. So yeah, it was it's an impediment to my journalism. It's been difficult to get back on my feet, and in that way, although they haven't stopped me writing, and they won't stop me writing, so we're going to keep on doing that. They took all my devices, all the main devices, so that's what they did. And but we've got a legal team, I've got a legal team, and we're strongly resisting it. I can't say too much about the details, but what I can say is we're taking very strong action to prevent them from accessing my devices, searching my devices. So, it's something that they've been doing to a lot of people. It's becoming, as tonight's meeting shows, it's becoming a case of who's going to be next now. But although I have received a lot of support, received a lot of popular support, and there's been some good media coverage of it, as you said, Asim, there's been no, not even a single mainstream media journalist has approached me or has reported on this. Nothing from The Guardian or any of the other mainstream newspapers, or broadcasters, So the only national newspapers that have covered it has been the Morning Star and the National in Scotland. So, as Tony alluded to, we've got a job ahead of us, I suppose. These kinds of laws, if they can be used against me, if they can be used against Richard, Sarah, it's going to be a question of who's next. It's going to be a question of which journalists will be next. These abuse of counter-terror law could be used against anyone, really, any journalist. So there's got to be some journalists out there who are asking, could they be next? Even some mainstream journalists might be asking themselves that. And so, one good thing is that the National Union of Journalists did put out a statement against what they did to Richard and what they did to me. I am a member of the NUJ, so yeah, they have supported me in that way. So that's a positive step. But I think even that has only come due to pressure of members, it has to be said. So, I think we have to keep up that pressure. I think that's important, and to build the campaign.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I think it's really difficult when you're in that moment. I don't think people realize how intrusive it is. I remember being stopped at a port and having my kind of devices taken off me and whatever else. But what I do is often my practice is to wipe my devices before I travel, so I'm traveling with a device that's completely empty. They get really mad about it because they're like, you know, why did you? Why? And I said to them, well, you know, whenever I travel through any kind of authoritarian country, I always make sure that my devices are clean because I wouldn't want to give my clients information away. I travel a lot for legal cases. Then they tried this other tactic where they were like, well, you know, privileged material is actual physical material. What's inside your head is your own intellectual property. So you can tell us, you know, what's inside your head. I'm like, that's not how legal privilege works. Everything relating to the cases that I work on is legally privileged, including the stuff that's inside my head. But it's amazing the kind of tactics they'll use to try and circumvent the law itself. And that's really what's at stake here. What's at stake is the rule of law, as most of us would understand it, as something that is transcendental to a system of laws that we have in place right now. So we are, in fact, appealing to a higher purpose and a higher status of the law than the system and the structure of violence that we are all currently being subjected to, particularly through counterterrorism legislation. It reminds me a bit of what Martin Luther King Jr. writes in his letter from a Birmingham jail, that in fact, that the highest respect that one can show for the law is to break a law that is unlawful, that is unconscionable, that goes against the moral conscience. And I think that is a perfect segue to speak about the next organization and our next speaker, Huda Mouri from Palestine Action, who are placing themselves at risk as an organization, as individuals, for the sake of that higher purpose of the law, which is to say that we know that there are inherent risks involved in what we are doing to try and shut down a weapons factory, a weapons system that is destroying lives every single day. But we are appealing to that higher, the higher purpose of the law in taking this action. So Huda, please tell us more about how, you know, and you know, just say that it's been a lot for you guys recently. There's been a lot of raids, a lot of arrests, and I just hope you guys are all okay and we're here for you.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's so good to be around other brilliant people and brilliant speakers. As we speak, we have nine people detained who've been in solitary confinement for, I believe, over 82 hours now. And this came after 10 people were raided and arrested on Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. And it was a coordinated attack across the country. They didn't bother knocking on people's doors. They drilled some people's doors off before they tried knocking on them, smashed through people's doors in order to basically abduct people from their homes, take them and hold them under the Terrorism Act. The reason that they're alleging that they're doing this is they're accusing these people of being involved in an action which took place on August the 6th against Elbit Systems. And this action allegedly cost the Israeli weapons maker over £1 million in damages. Six people drove a prison van into the relatively new research and development hub of Elbit Systems. And once inside, they destroyed Israeli quadcopter drones, the same drones we're seeing being used to massacre the people of Gaza. When those who did the action were arrested, they were also arrested under normal laws and then rearrested under the Terrorism Act. After they, the Filton 10, as they're now called, were arrested under the Terrorism Act, they were held for nearly a week in solitary confinement, interrogated repeatedly, and this is all without charge, because obviously the Terrorism Act allows the state to hold people without, for much longer periods of time, without charge, and strips away most of your rights, basically. But they were all charged with non-terror offences, yet they're now using the same terrorism offences they were initially arrested for and not charged with in order to arrest more people. So basically, they're abusing the terrorism legislation in order to use heavier powers and put more resources into their investigation, into these actions, and ultimately to try and deter Palestine Action. We've had, you know, different peaks of police oppression throughout the existence of Palestine Action. And ultimately, the state is desperate to deter us from our direct action campaign against Elbit Systems. And they have failed so far. They have failed to date, and they will continue to fail. Palestine Action is growing by the day, by the minute. People are not scared off. There is a genocide happening right now in Gaza. People are being massacred in Lebanon. And we are not going to stop until Elbit Systems is shut down as Palestine Action. It's as simple as that. But as we get closer to defeating Elbit Systems, the repression intensifies. And this has very real consequences for the people who take direct action, for the family members, as you'll hear from Claire, the mother of one of the Filton 10 members. In addition to the latest escalation, Richard Barnard, another co-founder of Palestine Action, was recently charged under the Terrorism Act, under Section 12(1)(a). And he basically faces three charges for two speeches at protests. One was on October the 8th, the other was on October 11th. And this came after a Zionist campaign, basically Harry's Place, other Zionist pages calling for him to be arrested. And of course, the police follow suit, arrest him, and subsequently charged him. He was actually arrested in November last year. And it took until August this year to charge him. And when he went to court, I was there in Westminster Magistrates Court for the first hearing, which starts off in the magistrates. The prosecution were very clear. They said the reason there was a delay is we had to wait for the Attorney General to approve the charges. This is the new Attorney General. So it wasn't the previous one never accepted the charges. The evidence will not have changed. A speech is a speech. You can't get more evidence on a speech. But it was the new Attorney General on the Labour government, Richard Hermer, who approved these charges. And a lot of these arrests and charges we're seeing under the Labour government. Interestingly, Richard Hermer, soon after he became the Attorney General, went on a low-key trip to Israel. Now, I don't understand how an Attorney General in this country, during a genocide, can go on a low-key trip. How can to Israel? How can that even be a sentence in the English language? But there we go. He went over there and it was very discreet. His Deputy Attorney General, Solicitor General, is Sarah Sackman, who was the Vice President of the Jewish Labour Movement, a notorious Zionist, an ideological Zionist in the Attorney General's office. One of the senior civil servants, the director of the Attorney General's office, is a guy called Doug Wilson. Doug Wilson was instrumental in creating the meetings between the Israeli embassy and the Attorney General in 2022, when the Israeli embassy and 2023 was lobbying the Attorney General in order to interfere in our cases, which you're not allowed to do in this country. You're not allowed to interfere. You're not allowed to have political interference, foreign interference in court cases. Yet we have concrete evidence that this has been happening. He's still in position. So even if you go from a Tory government to a Labour government, you've still got the same civil servants. You've got the same connections with Elbit Systems and the Israeli embassy. And ultimately, these are the people making the decisions. They're the ones making the decisions to charge people for terrorism. And so I think we all have to pay a closer attention to what's happening in the Attorney General's office and what political interference is happening. Because the prosecutors are obliged to remain free from improper influence. If there is improper influence, which there is, then it's an abusive process and they can't proceed with these cases. And clearly that's what's happening. But I think we need to go onto the front foot of exposing it while it's happening and not having to wait years and years in order to get justice and expose the truth of what's happening at this moment in time. I will just say Richard is going, he has his plea hearing in on Friday the 13th of December in Manchester Crown Court, and he'll be on trial on April the 14th. We will launch a fundraiser for his fees tomorrow, so any support will be appreciated. I think what's clear, though, is that, and this meeting shows that we are a united front in this, whether we're taking direct action, whether we're journalists or activists, or in many cases, both. We are united in the fight against this. And every single case, we have to resist every single case to not allow a precedent to be set. As Andrew Feinstein said at the start, an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
Absolutely, Huda. Thank you so much, and for all the work that Palestine Action do. I've said it many times that I don't think there is another organization out there right now that is more important than Palestine Action. You are literally stopping lives from being taken in Gaza through all of the bravery of your actionists, and I think that that effort must be applauded, but not just applauded. There has to be ranks of people that stand behind Palestine Action as they continue to do their work. So please, I encourage everybody to lend their support in whatever way they can, and whatever you feel, where you feel like you're able to make a contribution, make it something, but make Palestine Action the organization that you center in the course of your activism, because they are doing much more than anyone else, than any of us. We wanted to have one other speaker tonight, which would have been Maajid Freeman, but unfortunately, because of his legal case, he can't publicly appear. He has very, very strict bail conditions. But Maajid's case is very important in the, it kind of crosses so many of these discussions that we've been having already, as a citizen journalist, and in so many different facets, and the way that his home is raided, the way that his family were traumatized, severely traumatized by the police. This is an important case, but unfortunately, it's very difficult to speak about such cases and to have him speak himself when the bail conditions are created to specifically inhibit that ability to inhibit the prospect of humanizing yourself, of humanizing your case, and of course, lending your voice to the Palestinians. But really, what all these bail conditions are about, the theft of digital devices, all of these different aspects of repression are used specifically to inhibit the ability to get the message out there. That's why the people that you're hearing from today all have massive platforms. Platforms that have been taken away from the Palestinian people. And it's important that we acknowledge that and understand that that is what is taking place. And Maajid, especially amongst the Muslim community in the UK and abroad, was a significant voice that has been taken away from us through this particular repression. Now, we talked about the bravery of everybody before, in particular Palestine Action. And, it's the actionists within Palestine Action that really show that bravery. And I really want to salute young Zoe Rogers. She's 21 years old, literally half my age. It's crazy when I think about it in those terms. And we're very fortunate that we have Zoe's mother, Claire Rogers, with us. So Zoe's one of the Fulton 10 who has been in custody for, I think, probably like 2, 3 months by now. 3 months. Took action against Elbit Systems, and they're waiting trial in November 2025. So it's still some way away, but I'm hoping that inshallah, all of us will be there and present to help. Claire is also a cycle campaigner based in North London and a single parent of two girls. Now, here's the thing: when I sent your bio, Claire, I was just like, it doesn't sit right with me because, in 21 years of doing this work, so I started this when Zoe was born. I've met many families who become campaigners, many mothers who become campaigners, and they often, like you, decenter themselves. But bravery, I want to remind us, is a positive act. It's not something that just happens by chance. We choose bravery. And I really want to salute you, Claire, and all the other mothers who have come forward on behalf of their children, because you're choosing to act in a brave way. You're choosing to stand up for your children, to stand up for the cause as well. So thank you. And, we'd like to hear more from you about everything that you've experienced so far.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction and for having me tonight. I'm actually representing two other mothers as well who've both written very short statements, if I can start with reading those ones out to everyone. So first for Maria Head, she's the mother of Charlotte Head, age 28, who's in Bronzefield with prison with my daughter Zoe. She says Charlotte is a kind and considerate person who throughout her life has sought to help others less fortunate. She is a wonderful human who, rather than take her place at university, went to volunteer in Calais for 5 years, dedicating her adult life to the pursuit of making the world a safer place for everyone. She sees the injustice and genocide taking place in Gaza. Her only fault is to take action, where words failed to protest and try to stop it. What are the world leaders saying? That Israel is committing war crimes, crimes against humanity? What are they doing about it? Nothing. How can what she and the rest of the Fulton 10 be guilty of be anything, least of all terrorism? The UK government are the ones at fault, not the caring souls who have tried to raise awareness and stop the genocide. If the world was fair and just, Charlotte wouldn't be on remand. She'd be enjoying freedom, but she's not. And all because she's trying to make a difference and make the world safe for everyone. Charlotte, you are loved and supported more than you will ever know by family, friends, and the hundreds of people you have advocated for and personally helped in your short life. And I can testify to Charlotte's character because she's become a close friend of Zoe's in prison. Now a message from Sukaina Rajwani, whose daughter Fatima Zainab Rajwani turned 20 just before she was arrested, literally the day before. This is Sukaina's message to Shabana Mahmood, Secretary of State for Justice, who our petition is addressed to. Sukaina says, Shabana Mahmood, as an activist who staged a die-in in 2014 for the rights of Palestinians, you realise the importance of the freedom of protest and direct action. I urge you to stop the misuse of the terror legislation against direct actionists happening under your watch, and to stop the state support of genocide of the Palestinian people by keeping the interests of Israeli arms manufacturers in the UK above its own citizens. So those are my two of my fellow mums. And as we've heard, my name's Claire. And Zoe, my daughter, celebrated is the wrong word, but spent her 21st birthday in HMP Bronzefield last month. And I just want to say a few words about not so much the experience that we've been through, but a few different words. So I'd like to say that the use of terror legislation by this government is obviously a massive overreach, but it's also a massive tactical mistake on the part of the government. Why? Because it's radicalised the mums. Big mistake. I posted a picture of four of us after on Instagram after hearing at the Old Bailey, a very devastating traumatic hearing. And there are four of us with our arms around each other. And if you look in our eyes, it's a terrifying photo. And someone reposted it with the caption, and the polite version of the caption was, "Don't mess with mums." So we are forced to be reckoned with. And of course, it's not just mums. There's a whole lots of family members and loyal friends who form part of this Fulton 10 support group. We're a kind of a campaign in our own right. We are full of love and rage. We will not be silenced, and we're getting organised. Our petition to drop the use of terror legislation has reached 31,000 signatures, and I'm grateful to everyone who signed there. And I think Huda is going to put the link in the chat. So if you haven't signed it, please sign it and share it. We've appeared on BBC London, and we're just getting growing media interest every day. But I'd just like to use my remaining few minutes to have a few words with Sir Keir Starmer, if I may. So, Keir Starmer, this is what I want to say to you. When Zoe finally got to make her first phone call, nearly 2 weeks after she was arrested, her first words to me were, "Mum, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for putting you through all of this." And I said, "You have absolutely nothing to be sorry for. You have done a brave and beautiful thing. You are not the person who should be sorry. And one of the people who should be saying sorry is you, Keir Starmer. It is 100% because of your inaction that Zoe took action. It is because of your failure to stop the flow of arms to Israel from this country, along with other military and political support in contravention of international humanitarian law. It is because of your failure to listen to the millions of people who took to the streets, including my daughter, calling on you to stop supporting a genocide. It is because you continue to host on British soil the vile, vile Elbit Systems, Israel's main arms manufacturer, against the wishes of no doubt the vast majority of British taxpayers, if they only knew. And so Zoe and her fellow activists, as people of conscience, felt they had no choice but to act themselves. They got to the point where they could no longer sit back and watch another child being killed, knowing their country was complicit in this slaughter. And so, Keir Starmer, they chose to throw themselves bodily into the cogs of your war machine at massive personal cost, to try to do what you yourself should have done as soon as you got into government, stop arming Israel. How dare you call them terrorists? I love these words of Andrew Fenstein's that have been quoted already in the chat. I would strongly suggest that in any sane society, it should be a terrorism offence to support, enable and profit from genocide. Who is the terrorist here? I'm going to finish by reading you part of a poem that Zoe wrote in prison. Judge for yourself whether it is written by a person who wished to cause terror or to stop it. It's called Prison Conversations. When they ask why I did it, I tell them about the children, how their childhood is stolen from them, how their skeletons are left charred and smoking, how easily their bodies are crushed by falling buildings, how their skin melts as their flaming tents collapse around them. I tell them of the boy found carrying his brother's body inside his bloody backpack. I tell them of the girl whose hanging corpse ended at the knees. I tell them of the father holding up his headless toddler. And I say, I cannot stand for this. It can go on no longer. So I took action against Elbit, their weapons supplier. But I never forget to say that it was love, not hate, that called me. Watching their songs and dances for freedom, reading their hope-filled books, listening to their dreams of being doctors, teachers, journalists, and never giving up. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. That was exceptionally moving. And, you know, we could only wish Zoe and all the others so much goodwill. And, you know, hopefully there is a way that, you know, they can come out before their trial, that, you know, we can have them with us instead of being locked up behind these horrible, horrific, dehumanizing bars. Criminal justice in the UK is not fit for purpose. The system is not fit, and is not made for people like Zoe. It is soul destroying, but it's amazing to see that they are still holding on to that spirit that they have, that they recognize that this activism that they have and that they hold on to is so intimately connected to their experience in prison. And we have to play our role to keep that spirit alive. You know, for those of us who have been doing, you know, prisoner work with incarcerated communities for many years, letters are a lifeline to political prisoners. Political prisoners are immensely strong. They're amongst the strongest category of prisoners. You know, the spirit that they have is really exceptional and unbelievable. But they need human contact and human connection. They need to know that what they're doing is seen. It's important. It's important for their spiritual, mental, even kind of biological well-being to have that connection to the outside world. So whoever can, whoever has the ability, write a letter, write as many letters as you can, engage them in conversation, make them feel intellectually invigorated and spiritually uplifted by your presence in their lives through the process of writing letters. And of course, turn up. Whenever they have a hearing, turn up. Please do turn up. And, you know, speaking of incarcerated communities, I want to invite up Les Levido, who I've known for many, many years, who's worked as part of the campaign against criminalizing communities. He's intimately familiar with how communities across the UK have been at the extreme end of criminalization. Les, can we get you up, please?
Yeah, thanks to Asim for hosting this and for Tony for having organized it. Yeah, we've known each other, since the Terrorism Act 2000, because Cage and our campaign were attempting to organize resistance and solidarity against those unjust powers. Now, we're all outraged by how the British state has used the anti-terror powers against Palestine activists. But unfortunately, we should not be surprised for reasons I'll try to explain. And the history may help us to find more effective strategies to resist these powers. Earlier on in this event, Tony read out the official definition of terrorism in the Terrorism Act 2000. It's very broad. It includes the threat of serious damage to property. That is just the threat, even if there isn't damage to property, in ways designed to influence the government, which could mean this government or any government in the world, for a political cause. Now, just think about that broad definition. It could describe the entire history of class struggle, the entire history of anti-imperialist movements. Fortunately, the powers were not retroactive or of any actions that happened before the year 2000, but they did apply to any since then. And that meant that organizations anywhere could be and have been banned on the basis that their activities fit the broad definition. Moreover, any vague association here with such activities abroad become a terrorist crime, contingently as interpreted by the police, the Crown Prosecution Service, and the judiciary. To investigate such suspected crimes, the Act authorized strong executive powers, effectively to punish terror suspects without trial or even without charge. And those punishments include the ones we've heard from the people in this webinar. Long detentions, you could call it virtual kidnapping, confiscation of property as evidence in the investigation of the suspected crime. And of course, in the year 2000, we weren't totally dependent on our electronic devices as we are now, but it takes on that significance, as well as stopping people at ports of entry, where if you are interrogated and refusal to answer even just one question is a serious terrorist crime. These are all punishments without trial. And in this way, the powers created a permanent state of terror against anyone who dissents from UK foreign policy. And as we've heard, the police priority becomes persecuting dissenters rather than protecting the public. But why was this law enacted? If you think back to the year 2000, and they didn't even have the pretext of 9/11, that came a year later. And at that time, there was the Prevention of Terrorism Act 1974, whose main purpose was to terrorize Irish people and to turn them into police informers, which often happened, unfortunately. But they no longer had that pretext because the war had winded down. We had the Downing Street Agreement and so on. But they found new pretexts to make anti-terror powers even more comprehensive and extreme than before. Let's listen to Professor Paul Wilkinson, who was the favorite academic of securocrats. He was commissioned to write an advisory report to Parliament on the need for new and even permanent anti-terror powers. He said in his report, a terrorist group looks internationally for any ideological, political, or diplomatic support that it can obtain. Sub-state terrorism is typically the weapon of the weak. That's his lingo. We could translate it into plain English to say that national liberation movements fighting oppressive regimes sought solidarity in other parts of the world, including the UK. So he diagnosed the problem for the entire imperialist project, that there are such solidarity groups which give at least verbal solidarity and help to legitimize those resistance movements and delegitimize the terrorist regimes who are persecuting the people. Now, listen to Tony Benn, MP, in his speech in 2001 at our meeting in Parliament, which formed our campaign against criminalizing communities. He said, "The anti-terror framework is an agreement among governments of the world that no government is to be challenged from inside with support from outside. It has little to do with terrorism," meaning as it was commonly understood at that time. "In a global economy, Britain wants to trade with repressive regimes. And if they find that these regimes are complaining that people in London are campaigning for Kurdish rights, Tamil rights, or Kashmiri rights, then the British government is expected to respond." And that list is instructive because those people, or those rights being denied, correspond to some of the organizations that were banned as terrorists. That is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, the Tamil Tigers, Kashmiri groups, and so on. And eventually Hamas, that came a few years later after the act. Now, what was the purpose of banning those organizations in other countries? They don't exist here. That's just the point. Migrant groups here were opposing the oppressive regimes in those countries, and the ban was used as a pretext to persecute any migrant group here that criticized those regimes, and especially criticized Britain's collusion with those regimes. And the people from those groups were regularly persecuted using the powers that I just described, the powers that are now being used against Palestine activists. And that was the basis for our campaign against criminalizing communities. Muslims were also persecuted, even if they had no connection to those regimes. But that would need a different talk than this one. So, as we said on our website 2 decades ago, the anti-terror powers define terrorism more broadly, thus blurring any distinction between anti-government protest and violence against civilians. They label numerous organizations as terrorists as a basis for placing entire communities under suspicion of associating with terrorism. They detain and prosecute people for suspected activities which could just as well be handled under other laws, such as the ordinary criminal law that's used against football hooligans if they're prosecuted at all, such as damage to property. They cast a wide net for treating more people as terror suspects, and in all these ways help to undermine struggles for national self-determination by persecuting support here for those struggles. In these ways, the politics of fear helps to intimidate dissent and so shield the government's foreign policies from criticism and protest. And the connection with other countries is crucial here, because even before the war on terror, but that is when this act came into force, and especially since then, the UK's allies routinely brand their internal opposition as terrorist, while portraying their own role as counter-terror activities. So the UK anti-terror regime has legitimized that narrative of state terrorist regimes. Through that regime, the authorities here persecute any symbolic support for violent resistance abroad, which is called sub-state terrorism, or even resistance which may threaten property there or here.
Sorry, sorry,
So,
Les, I'll have to ask you to
okay.
round up. Just sorry,
So,
thank you.
since a year ago, greater mass protest here has led the UK government to treat Palestine solidarity campaigns as a suspect community, as terrorist suspects who should be subjected to punishment without trial. The problem runs deeper than simply the abuse of anti-terror powers. The problem is the entire so-called anti-terror regime. So I conclude with a question: what collective action can undermine that regime? Thanks.
Thank you so much, Les, and sorry for having to cut
Okay.
you off. We've been going for an hour and a half, and I
Yeah,
really
I
want to give
understand.
Richard
Yeah.
Medhurst some time, who's our next speaker. Richard, well, is a journalist, and he was arrested under Section 12 of the Terrorism Act, unfortunately, and also experienced a Schedule 7 stop at the airport. Richard, please, thank you for sharing with us tonight.
Thanks to everybody else for contributing and to Cage for setting this up. It's not correct that I was held under Schedule 7, but they did take all my devices and they arrested me with about six police officers came to the plane and took me and kept me for about 24 hours. So as far as I know, I think that was the first time they used 12-1A against a journalist, and it was on August 15th. So this is after Labour took power, and ironically, because I think we had Claire just a moment ago talking about her daughter and other activists from Palestine Action being in prison. I think just a few hours, actually, the same day that I flew, I was actually playing a clip of her speaking outside the prison and talking about the Filton 10. So I was tweeting about them as well as I was getting on the plane, and the Terrorism Act being used to detain them for over 100 hours. So I never imagined that they would then arrest me under the Terrorism Act by the time I landed. So, just to give you some background, they've extended the investigation now. I was supposed to go back to the UK and surrender myself to the police station about a week ago, but the police chose to extend it another 3 months. And if I'm charged and then convicted, it carries up to 14 years in prison. So you can understand why it impedes my reporting. I don't feel like I can work or speak freely, and I think that's the point. The government want to silence people. They want to make people who are critical of British foreign policy and support of Israel afraid to speak. So it is effectively using terror tactics to silence us. And of course, they took my electronic devices, both analog and digital. So that was everything. I mean, phones, headphones, microphones. They've given back, I think, some microphones, but they still have the mobile telephones, so they're asking for the passwords. And it's extremely harrowing, right? It's designed that is what we all have in common. It's that the states are using fascist powers to basically make examples out of us in civil society, whether we're activists or journalists or both, and they want other people to be afraid to talk and to speak out. And obviously, I think that there was the option of saying nothing, but I could see from how they were treating me and making a giant mess of things that there was something very, very unprecedented about this. I didn't actually grasp that I'd been arrested for several hours until after I was arrested. So, I assumed they were going to schedule 7 me, but no, it was 12-1A. And as Tony was going into detail earlier, it's so abstract and vague. It criminalizes the truth, essentially. It criminalizes opinions, and you simply can't work, whether you are doing commentary as a journalist or whether you're just reporting as a journalist. So, both ways, it's like, how can you even approach topics like this? And there's one MP, Sarah Owen, who contacted the security minister, Jarvis, about my case. I didn't ask her to. I think it's one of her constituents who did that. And his words were in response that there's no absolute defense of journalism under counterterrorism legislation. So I want people to remember that this is Western democracy. What he's saying essentially is that, if they want to, they can just misuse the Counterterrorism Act against journalists. There's nothing to impede that, right? And it's astonishing how they're able to make such excuses for this behavior. Not to mention the fact that if you look at Article 10, right to free speech under the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the Human Rights Act in this country, and also even the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, right to free speech and the public's right to be informed, the Terrorism Act infringes on both of these things. And we were discussing the definition of terrorism. I find it particularly funny or ironic, rather, that they did this to me, considering my background, because my father was in the police and later on wrote a counterterrorism training course for the United Nations. And that was passed by the General Assembly, including by the UK. And in his definition of terrorism, how his definition differs from most is that it includes state terrorism. In that definition, it includes things that we're seeing in Gaza right now: depopulation. In the book, it has the Holocaust, for example, the Armenian genocide are mentioned as examples of state terrorism. So I was just flicking through it the other day, and it's just like it described none of my behavior or the behavior of the other people in this Zoom panel, but it described all of the behavior of the government, of the British government. It's astonishing. And the fact that, Keir Starmer, who was saying a few months ago that Israel has the right to deny people water and electricity in Gaza. Well, I hope he knows that just yesterday, Netanyahu and Gallant, they've been indicted by the ICC precisely because of that, because of what Keir Starmer was talking about, which he thinks is legal, which is to deny people life essentials like water, like food, like electricity. So, given his background, as a lawyer, you would think that he would know better. But apparently they think that they can behave with such impunity that it doesn't matter. And so what they're doing to us now, it's the same hypocrisy we see from the Israelis. It's this, we're going to commit acts of terrorism. And then anyone who criticizes us, we're going to call them terrorists. And that's what the British government is doing. I think it's important to see what Keir Starmer and Labour are doing as not a random kind of stint, but they are supporting Israel by silencing us, by going after us, by trying to prevent us from, carrying out our duties, our jobs, and making sure that civil society is too afraid to function. It is state terrorism. They are using terror tactics, and it is an additional manner in which they support Israel, aside from arms, aside from intelligence. This is another support role that his government is carrying out. So in all frankness, it is Keir Starmer who is the terrorist. It's the Labour government, and before them, the Conservatives who helped, who were there right at the beginning, who are the terrorists, who literally behave in a manner that is designed to cause mass suffering and mass casualties. And I mean, the irony of it is quite sickening, to say the least. Not to mention the fact that you have Israelis coming back to the UK who've committed God knows what crimes. I mean, take your pick. Maybe they participated in killing children or gang rapes in prisons. Who knows, right? There's so many crimes being committed in Gaza. And none of these people, as far as I know, have been arrested or even questioned, right? So the state is silencing us, continuing to participate in genocide, and then also turning a blind eye to active participants on the ground in this genocide, which I really think would make even the most, even the worst of criminals blush. But that's where we're at right now. And I'm grateful, of course, to the NUJ, the IFJ and CAGE and Code Pink and all these groups for their support and for the important role that they play. And I think that's exactly what they need to continue doing. It's being active in civil society and not letting any of this pressure get to us. And of course, that goes for all the people who are becoming targets of this misuse of the Terrorism Act. Again, it's not wrong to have anti-terrorism legislation that is very strictly defined, but using it in this manner is beyond the pale, to say the least.
Thank you so much. And that's such a great end to, what has been a really important night, I feel, at least anyway. I think for a start, what we've shown is that, different activists, different groups, different backgrounds, coming from different traditions, coming together. First of all and foremost, because we all understand that there is a genocide taking place right before our very eyes. And we're having to witness it. And we're all I think, dedicated to the task of trying to end that genocide. But then also at the same time, realizing that there are layers to countering this genocide. And part of that is showing solidarity and standing with one another as we're trying to support the Palestinians. So it's not just that we support the Palestinians, but we have to support one another as well, because this is structural. The repression of the state, it's targeted at us, yes, but we have to understand that the function of targeting us is to isolate Palestinians, is to stop them from getting the international support and solidarity that they need. And so we have to do both things at the same time. We can't say, look, everything must focus on Palestine alone. If we understand that everything that is going on here, everything that everybody spoke about today in relation to the counterterrorism regime in the UK, is part of the process of trying to delegitimize the Palestinian struggle. We have to protect our activists here as well as defending Palestinians over there. So let's all make sure that we support organizations like Palestine Action, that we're out there speaking about supporting all the brilliant journalists, standing up for the mums, the very brave mums who are out there doing their best to keep their families together, and helping those who are inside by writing to them and being with them and standing in solidarity with them. So, you know, it just leaves me to say thank you. We've been going for almost an hour and 45 minutes. That's really incredible, considering that there's been over 250 people consistently with us throughout. So it just shows you the strength of feeling that there is out there for supporting this type of work. So I hope you all had an illuminating evening, and that you have a great remainder of the rest of your weekend. So thank you so much, and all the best. Take care, everybody.